Apoptosis going mad, my liver's gonna fail. Maybe it's from the radium I use to paint my nails. Well, say you hate me, carbon date me, throw me in the sea. I'll be back with time because I'm made of stardust and chemistry. Of stardust and chemistry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Cowboy Chemistry. I'm your host, Dylan Gardner. My pronouns are they, them, and I'm a PhD candidate here at Texas Tech University. My guest today is Corey Evans, 8th grade teacher and comedian. How are you doing today?
I am tired. I had a basketball game against my students today, so I'm sore and tired, but excited.
Awesome. Did you win?
We did win. I'm a winner, so.
I mean, it's 8th grade students, right?
Yeah, and it was closer than it should have been. But I'm out of shape. It was bad.
Well, you still won. You can hold on to that.
That's all that matters. We lost in volleyball last year, so.
So, this is a chemistry podcast. How much chemistry would you say you knew?
I would say, like, what are we going to, like, you're a PhD candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, let's just say you're 100. I would say 17.
Okay. So, not nothing.
I mean, I know there's a periodic table, and I know chemistry makes medicine. And that's an alcohol, I think, and that's about it. So maybe a 7.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about something really basic. We're going to go over the history of the atom.
Okay.
This is not meant to be like an in-depth explanation. It's more about an overview of the concept and understanding of the atom throughout time and cultures. The first half will mostly kind of be religious and philosophical.
Okay.
And then we're going to get into a little bit more of the science, so.
Okay, I like that. I like starting religious and philosophical. That's when they just kind of made it up, right?
Yeah, it's completely thought experiment.
I can make things up, yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, though, it's kind of funny how close some people really got. They were like, you listen to that and you're like, yeah, that sounds like what we think now.
So can I, like, I mean, like, I really am a 7. Can we start with what an atom is? Like, can I take a guess what an atom is?
Absolutely.
Because in my head, I was like, an atom is the smallest particle known to man. But that can't be true because there are things inside the atom, right?
So correct.
So, the things inside have to be smaller. It's the smallest something, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the smallest building block?
So, I wouldn't call it a building block.
Okay.
So, the best explanation I think I've heard is that atom is the smallest unit that cannot be changed by chemical means.
Okay.
Right? So, every chemical reaction that you think of on a normal, like in a normal instance, that's not changing an atom.
Okay.
Right? That's changing the bonds between atoms.
Okay.
So, the smallest unit that cannot be changed by chemical means.
Okay. That makes a little bit of sense.
Yeah, because you're right. There are things that are smaller than the atom, right? Like electrons,
mm-hmm.
neutrons, protons. The smallest thing would be considered an elementary particle. So if you ever hear something called an elementary particle, that's a particle, that's the smallest particle.
Okay.
And that's quantum physics stuff that we're not going to get into today.
I've watched Ant-Man. I've got quantum physics.
Let's start off with the oldest concepts of atomism. So atomism is just even the concept that things are made of small, indivisible particles, right? The oldest versions of atomism is actually from ancient India. So the first recorded person to have written a description of what something would be considered an atom was a Vedic sage called Aruni. He lived in 8th century BCE and proposed a substance called kana that were particles too small to be seen, massed together into substances and objects of experience. That was what he called his description.
That sounds pretty close.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Except what was the last part? Massed together and...
Massed together into the substances and objects of experience. So
okay.
The things that we experience are made of particles that are too small to be seen.
Okay. That doesn't sound very philosophical. That sounds like he was, like, really close. I mean, yeah. I understand very little, but I'd be like, 8,000 years BCE is, that's, I'd say he nailed it. He is ahead of his time.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of them are like that. You're like, oh, that's pretty close considering you couldn't measure anything.
It upsets me that this guy, like, if you ask this guy 8,000 years BCE what an atom was, 800 years BCE what an atom was, he was closer than I am and I have the internet. Like, he was definitely closer than I was.
I mean, you're both right. So there were two schools of atomism in India, Charvaka and Ajivika. Originated as early as 7th century BCE in India, Charvaka was a kind of like skepticism in India, so kind of like what we would think of as atheist, but not, I mean, obviously it's in their own context.
Mm-hmm.
So they rejected a lot of religious and metaphysical theories about the universe in India. Part of Hinduism, so they did not believe in any gods, they didn't believe in souls, afterlives, or reincarnation. One of the major principles of Charvaka is the rejection of interface to establish valid universal knowledge and metaphysical truths. So basically, the idea was that nothing that we can experience here is giving us any information about what's happening in the afterlife.
Okay.
So like, it's you can't see a set of things and then infer knowledge. All inferred knowledge is conditional.
Okay, so they're just like, anything that's happening here tells us nothing about life beyond.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like, I was in college, like, just really, like, raging against the machine, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, Hinduism was huge back then, right? Like, it was probably... I don't know history either. I talk like I know a lot of things. I need your listeners to know. I know nothing, but I will talk like I'm sure. But, like, I think, like, to not believe in Hinduism in India during this time probably would have been pretty radical.
It would definitely be counterculture. I'm
yeah.
not sure how radical it is.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not an expert in Indian history either, but it was definitely a counterculture.
Yeah. And so that was the first one, chakra, right? Did I say that right?
I believe it's Charvakas.
Charvaka. Chakra is something completely different. I'm sorry.
So Ajivika school is known for its fate doctrine, determinism. There's a lot of modern atheists that kind of believe this too. There's no free will, right? Everything
okay.
is caused by, everything's predetermined, everything's caused by physics. And everything that is happening and will happen is all preordained and a function of cosmic principles. So some people do believe this today, too.
And there are religious, because you said, I know there are atheist people who believe that. I think there are religious schools of thought that believe that as well.
Yeah, the only difference is that in their doctrine, God is the one who decides
okay.
the preordination versus, the distinction here is that nature, physical things are causing the preordination instead of God or God's
okay.
deciding.
So like our deep, kind of, I'm here to be the dumb person. So kind of like our DNA is like coded into us a certain way, like the same way like if you coded a robot and knew enough about it, like
mm-hmm.
you would know what its actions are going to be, kind of that?
Yeah,
okay,
exactly,
cool.
Yeah. They also believed that karma
mm-hmm.
was a fallacy. So there was no such thing as karma because things were preordained. And through that, not believing karma and this kind of belief that everything was preordained, they came up with another theory of elements and atoms that actually ended up being adopted into Hinduism. So a lot of Hinduism now uses their elements and atoms, even though they, my understanding is they're another counterculture, so they were not Hindus themselves. So their beliefs held that there were 7 Kayas. I believe Kayas was kind of their word for element, assemblage, collection, category.
Okay.
It's not exactly the same thing as what we would consider an element today. And theirs were earth, water, fire, air, and these are my favorite, joy, sorrow, and jiva, life.
joy, sorrow, and jiva means life.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they took those as elements
yes.
as well. That's, yeah, that is really interesting, because I've never heard, I mean, I've heard earth, water, whatever the band is, earth, wind, fire, whatever.
yeah.
but I've never heard, like, someone be like, joy as an element, life mm-hmm. as an element. And was it grief? Was that the other?
Sorrow.
Sorrow, mm-hmm. okay.
So, obviously, the first four are matter, and the last three are non-matter. So, I think that non-matter was kind of their idea of energy, like our idea of energy, their idea mm-hmm. of energy, but they didn't make any distinction between matter and energy.
Yeah.
And so these elements, they had properties. So one is that they cannot be created nor destroyed. They're barren in that they never multiply or reproduce. And they have an existence independent of the other. So none of them are, they're not mixtures of anything. And they called the elements, and they made them, they're made up of paramanu, where the atoms are defined as which cannot be further subdivided, cannot penetrate other atoms, and which is neither created nor destroyed, retains its identity, never growing, expanding, splitting, nor changing.
Okay, and is that true in today's atom that, because it said you can't split. Well, no, you can't split an atom. That's the
right.
thing. That's
so you
but
can,
like we couldn't until like the atomic bomb, right?
Basically, yeah, like 1940s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't split an atom and like be okay.
You can't split an atom again by chemical means.
Okay.
So yeah, it takes a lot to split an atom.
And we're gonna have another episode all about splitting atoms.
Yes.
Eventually, so I don't want to step on toes.
But
yeah. like, that's going to be a great episode. I'm going to listen to it.
I just checked out a whole bunch of books about it, so.
That's fun.
And so they're versions of elements. They move, assemble, and combine to form everything that we perceive. So that's all pretty accurate. You know, what they called their atoms, what they were, is not what we think of today. But, like, these properties are pretty much the same.
Yeah.
I liked some of their descriptions too. Atoms can be in a diversity of forms, dense forms like diamonds, or loose forms like hollow bamboo. Yeah, and again, this was the belief of determinism, the no free will. Everything experienced, joy, sorrow, life, is all just functions of atoms operating under cosmic rules.
That's not very romantic.
No, but it's... So the next style of atomism is from Buddhism. They had what would be considered an Aristotelian style of atomic theory, so Aristotle. Their version began in the 4th century BCE, and they have four kinds of atoms corresponding to your standard elements, earth, air, fire, water. Each of these elements had like a specific property associated with it. So either solid or motion, you know, so earth would be solid, water is motion, so.
Was earth the only solid then? Because it'd be, fire is pretty motion-y.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically.
I'm sorry, I have lots of questions.
And then later Buddhist philosophers considered atoms to be point-sized, durationless, and made of energy.
What does durationless mean? Like they last forever?
I believe it's that they kind of exist and don't exist.
Okay, that...
It's very Buddhist thought
cool.
in that... Yeah, my understanding is very, like, they're there, but they're not there.
Okay.
Hard to explain. I don't know if I fully understand it myself.
I'm just saying, okay, like, I understand. I'm good with that, too.
Now we get to what most people are familiar with when it comes to atomic theory, and we get to ancient Greece. Most chemistry lessons that you'll get on the history of the atom starts in ancient Greece.
Okay.
Because that's where we get, that's kind of a direct line to our modern thoughts on it. But I did want to start with the older theories, also because they're really interesting and different, but also correct, you know.
Yeah, and we're like way ahead of their time,
yeah.
which is awesome.
Yeah, and, you know, especially in a time where, again, everything's thought experiments, gotten it pretty good.
Yeah.
In ancient Greece, the concept of the atom started about 400 BC. The first big philosopher to proclaim atomism was Leucippus. He and his more well-known pupil, Democritus. Democritus is sometimes called the father of modern science, is given credit on being the first atomists and defining what what in their mind an atom is. Obviously, they weren't the first atomists, but they're the first Greek atomists,
yeah,
for sure. Democritus is the one we have written down what his view on it was. Everything is composed of atoms, which are physically but not geometrically indivisible, and that between atoms there lies empty space, and these atoms are indestructible and have always been and always will be in motion, and that there is an infinite number of atoms and of kinds of atoms which differ in shape and size.
Is that pretty true, like, from what we know now?
Some parts are true, so
okay.
The always in motion, that there's empty space in between atoms, that part is true. There's not an infinite number of atoms. Someone's done the calculation of how many atoms exist. It's a lot, but it's not
like
infinite.
Like in the universe?
In the universe.
Okay.
Or it's an estimate. I mean, it's not 100%.
But, like, as far as, like, my mind goes, it's infinite. So, like...
Yeah. It's
so, like,
definitely bigger than we can fathom, so it's not...
Okay.
It's not completely incorrect, but there is, like, a set number.
Anything
right?
over a billion is infinite to me. Like, billionaires just have infinite money in my eyes.
I mean, they definitely have more money than they could ever spend in their lifetime. Like, people have said you have to spend... I think they said they had to spend, like, almost $1 million an hour or something ridiculous to spend all their money within their own lifetime.
That's ridiculous. Okay.
But, yeah. And then the part that's not really true is that they're different shapes.
All atoms are basically the same shape?
Generally.
Okay.
I mean, there are mathematical models that predict the general shape, but also it's mostly empty space, right?
Okay.
So they have a shape, it's mostly spherical, ellipsoid kind of shapes, and then the orbitals, and we'll get more into that. Yeah, they have a very, it's not super different, like they were saying, like, one's a ball, and one has, like, hooks, and,
oh, okay,
you
so
know,
they're,
like,
really weird out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And just to be clear here, there's actually a more obscure philosopher called Mocus the Phoenician, and apparently he was the starter of the concept of atomism before Democritus, and a lot of big-name scientists, Isaac Newton, Robert Boyle, gives credit to Mocus over Democritus, but nobody knows who Mocus is, so Democritus is still the one who, like, popularized it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Mocus the Phoenician is... just a very not known philosopher, but I just wanted to do give him the credit because he was actually the first.
Yeah.
Of course, at this point in history, science had not been invented yet. The theory of what the different sizes and shapes were that gave them different properties. So iron atoms were solid and strong with hooks that locked them into a solid.
Okay.
Water atoms are smooth and slippery. And salt atoms, because of their taste, were considered sharp and pointed.
I get where they like get these. Like, I mean, like, I'm like, what do you mean science wasn't invented? I thought science was just a thing that existed.
So science is considered like a method, right?
Okay.
Science in general is a method. Yeah, there comes a point with Robert Boyle, kind of. At least he just starts chemistry anyway, really. He's considered, like, the first modern chemist.
Okay.
Before that point, you have alchemy, which is, like, science-ish.
We're
right.
Just trying stuff.
Yeah, there's not a set process like there is today.
So it's, like, the difference, like, they didn't have to prove any of this? Like, a guy just, like, one day was like, salt atoms taste spiky. And people were like, yeah. I mean, like, we can't prove you wrong. And so, like... And then, like, science, the idea behind science is, like, you can say, I think this happens, but, like, I still have to prove it.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the you know, the scientific method, that process of how we prove things. Like, because before that, people were even arguing, like, can we take physical measurements? Can we trust our senses enough to even take measurements? Like, those were the arguments happening before science.
Okay.
Because there are philosophers out there who... didn't believe that anything that we physically saw was real.
What, metaphysics? Is that metaphysics?
Yeah, and we'll kind of talk about a philosopher here who thinks that math is the real world. He does. This is all illusionary.
Okay.
And that reality is math.
I hope not.
Yeah, and air atoms were considered light and whirling. pervading all other material. So it fills all its containers, which is true today. And then connections were explained by material links, like machines. So like, you know, how iron atoms had hooks, so they were like hook and eyes. Others were described as like ball and joint sockets.
Okay.
So that's how things were like connecting together, were just physical connect, like how we would think in 3D of a physical connection. And in this theory, all atoms were considered inert, and any changes or interactions were mechanical in nature. So again, how we think in 3D, there's not really chemical changes. If you burn something, like, you're just ripping things apart, like it's...
Okay.
You know, which they kind of thought fire as a element and not a chemical reaction, but fire in today's world is a chemical reaction,
yeah.
Right? But anything that we would think of as a chemical reaction today, they thought of in mechanical terms. If you're like ripping things apart or stitching them together,
okay.
It's all very, like I said, mechanical. And then their pure elements were water, air, and metal. So you have gold, silver,
yeah.
Antimony, lead. Those, they, again, people debated. So
yeah.
What exactly were considered elements and weren't were kind of a person-to-person thing. But everything, and but they pretty much everyone agreed that they were just mixtures of these elements, those who were atomists,
mm-hmm.
and you just mix them together. And so in order for them, for atoms to like move and mix together, there had to be a void. A lot of people had issues with the concept of a void. So that was where a lot of the debate was, because the idea that nothing existed, like that there could be nothingness.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like that very concept that there was nothing, that there was empty space,
mm-hmm.
was very controversial. And so there were even philosophers out there. One was Parmenides, who denied that motion, change, and the void even existed. So nothing was really moving. There was no void. There was no change. It was all an illusion.
Okay.
And he was one of the people that explicitly rejected sensory experiences. He did not think sensory experiences were real or a way to understand the universe at all.
Meaning like seeing, hearing, smelling,
yes.
Like he'd be like, yeah, you're just seeing things, like that's your brain doing tricks and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
He believed that you could only reach truth by purely abstract thinking.
Okay.
So
he sounds like just a hoot. He sounds so fun to hang out with.
Right? That pain you're feeling, it's not real. Just ignore it. It'll go away. It's not real. So he believed that all existence was a single, all-encompassing, all-unchanging mass. And that concept is known as monism. So
okay.
It's kind of it's one of the opposites of atomism. So everything, it's all the same.
Like everything, like not just like feelings, but like this desk is part of the floor. And
yes.
Floor. Okay.
We're no different from anything else. There is no change.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Good for him.
Yeah. And so Democritus kind of accepted some of these critiques, but in general, disagreed with the idea that change is an illusion. Essentially, he challenged to know if it was an illusion, how the illusion worked, right? Like how, if it's an illusion, how is it working? Democritus concluded that the universe was made of Parmenidean entities, atoms.
Okay.
So what he was calling, you know.
So that's what we'd call atoms, but he didn't call it an atom, obviously.
Right.
Okay.
And then they move around in a void. And the void is infinite and provides the space for which atoms can pack or scatter differently. And the different possible packings and scatterings within the void made up the shifting outlines and bulk of objects that we organisms feel, see, hear, eat, smell, taste. That's what makes up everything. And so it was kind of a compromise with Parmenides, but also kind of a, you're wrong.
Yeah, he kept the void, and people didn't like the void because, like, is the void true? Is that, like, because
yeah.
There's space between atoms, like, that's kind
exactly.
of the void?
And, I mean, honestly, atoms are, our modern idea of an atom are mostly empty space, right? You have the nucleus
yeah.
that has most of the mass, and then a lot of empty space in which electrons move around in.
And so people just didn't like the idea that there could exist nothing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because, like, the idea of nothing is challenging, right? Like, if you
mm-hmm.
think of the vastness of the universe, for example, like some people get really even just unnerved at the idea of all that empty space.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it kind of came down to of like, and in a, of course in our day-to-day life, there is no nothing, right? Everything mm-hmm. is filled in with air. And so they're like, there's air everywhere. So there's yeah. There's no void, there's no nothing. So to them, there's like, there is no nothing. And there's no way to measure anything. So there's no way to prove that there's not nothing or that there is nothing. I think it's just the unnerving idea of the thought yes. that there is nothing.
See, that's great about science not existing. So you'd be like, I don't like nothing, so it doesn't exist.
Exactly. And then he also threw in there that while organisms may feel hot or cold, that temperature doesn't exist. So there's no real existence to temperature. I'm not sure why he threw that in there.
Was this our boy Democritus? Democritus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's like, they're simply sensations produced by the different packings and scatterings of the atoms in the void that compose the objects that organisms sense as being hot or cold. But hot or cold is not a thing.
Okay.
Like, temperature's not a thing. But again, this is all a thought experiment anyway.
Yeah.
But I was just like, interesting thing you threw in there.
He just threw that. Like, his, like, wife was like... was like, it's too hot in this house. And he was like, no, it's not. It doesn't exist. Sorry, honey.
Don't touch the thermostat.
I'm the philosopher.
So after Democritus, we get everyone's favorite philosopher, Plato. Plato absolutely hated Democritus and everything he decided. Plato wanted all of Democritus' books burned. Plato argued against atomism, stating that atoms just crashing into each other and other atoms could never produce the beauty and form of the world. So it was too random. Plato thought that our world was an illusion and that the real world was math.
Okay.
So this is the math. Plato was the math guy. And the elements fire, air, water, and earth were just geometric shapes. So the earth was a cube because it was flat and stable. Fire was a tetrahedron because it's pointy and sharp and the edges made it more mobile.
Okay.
And then the points and edges of an octahedron and an icosahedron were blunter, and so they were less mobile, and they were assigned to air and water.
It's weird that he was like, air and water are less mobile.
Than fire.
I mean, I don't know. I would be so bad if I lived in this time. Like, he'd be like, fire is a pointy, and I'd be like, yeah, sounds right. Like, I don't care. Sure, Plato. Like...
Yeah, and then all of these bodies were then decomposed into triangles. So, okay. Like, in his mind, triangles were kind of the atom of the different elements.
Okay. Because, like, yeah. Triangles can make a cube, which is
right.
The earth, and then, like, triangles can make all the other shapes.
Exactly.
Okay. I'm on board with you, Plato. He seems right.
And then, sometime before 330 BC, Aristotle put his say into the debate. His theory was that the elements of fire, air, earth, and water were continuous and not made of atoms. Also didn't believe in the void. He said it violated contemporary understandings of physical principles. Again, physics as our modern physics was not really invented yet. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is well before Isaac Newton, Newtonian physics. None of that is
thing
yet.
Like, no real science exists yet.
No, nothing that we, as a modern person, would recognize as science.
Okay, yeah.
Aristotle believed that change took place not by the rearrangement of atoms to make new structures, but by transforming matter from what it is into its potential to a new actuality. So a piece of wet clay, when acted upon by a potter, turns into its a potential, which could be a drinking mug.
Okay.
So... obviously, you can't change things into stuff that it can't turn into.
He sounds like a motivational speaker. It's like, we can hit your potential. I love that, like, the two people I've known are Plato and Aristotle, and, like, they were so wrong. Like, they, like, completely... right? Like...
I mean...
They're kind of the biggest misses we've seen so far.
Yeah, I would say the previous ideas of what an atom were more accurate than their models.
Yeah. And they're like the guys. They're like the guys people are like, they're the, I don't know.
Well, really, they were the guys that, I don't want to say put us in a dark age, but they were the prevailing theory for the longest time.
Okay.
Right? So, especially Aristotle. So Aristotle developed a theory called minima naturalis, So basically, this was a concept that natural substances could be divided and still retain its essential character until a natural minimum. So it's kind of like atomism, except that the natural minimum was not conceptualized by like it being physically indivisible. It's just when that substance stopped being that substance.
Okay.
And then it would break down into the elements, which were water, fire, earth, and air. If you had something like a rubber ball, as you break down the rubber ball, you just get little pieces of rubber ball as far as you go down, as far as you can go down, until you reach a natural minimum, and then it would decompose into its elements.
So, like, it would go back to the earth or whatever rubber originally came from. Okay.
Mm-hmm. He also had this idea that every physical thing is composed of matter and then form, which constitutes its property. So that same rubber ball, the rubber would be the matter, and its shape, the spherical ball shape, is its form. And so everything, all its properties are determined by those two things and those two things alone. Which isn't completely wrong, but also not completely right.
And when you said they put us in the Dark Ages, you mean like the atomic, like the atom Dark Ages, or like the Dark Ages in general?
Just like the concept of the atom.
Okay.
In that people really stuck with Aristotle's idea of this natural minimum for a really long time.
Okay.
So from now until what I'll call the atomist renaissance.
Okay.
Which, like, this is like 300 BC, and then the atomist renaissance is the 17th century.
Wow. Okay. We got a ways to go.
Yeah. That's why I say like a dark age, in the fact that like people just kept with Aristotle for a really long time.
Because they're like, he's the king.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't go at the king. Okay.
Yeah. And honestly, they had no other reason to change it, you know, because his explanation did do what it needed to do for the time. Right.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked at an atom?
What do you mean?
Like, can you see an atom? Like, I mean, like, I know you can't with your eyes,
mm-hmm.
but like, is there like a microscope that can see an atom?
So the only thing I've ever seen that is a single atom is there's a picture of it that won a big award a few years ago, and it's one atom fluorescing. And so what you see is a little spot of light.
Okay.
So you can't really see the atom, but you can see this little spot of light that is coming from a single atom.
Okay. I think I get atoms and cells mixed up.
Yeah, so you can, like, see cells.
Yeah, cells are made up of atoms.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Okay. Because I was like, I don't know if we can, like, if we have a microscope that can see atoms, but not really. Like, you can't take, I thought, like, we were going to end this episode with, you're like, come on, Corey, let's go look at an atom. And I was going to be like, cool.
No, it doesn't go that small. Also, I don't think we have, I think the smallest we can see is 10 nanometers.
Okay.
So, and then atom is in the angstrom range, depending on which atom you're talking about. And so it's like an order of magnitude smaller. So like 10 to the nanometer is 10 to the negative 9, and then an angstrom is 10 to the negative 10.
So we're not even like close.
I mean, it's close by, depends on what your standard of close is. We can't see an atom, but like,
my standard of close is like, I wanted to see one. And
I
it's
mean,
not
that's
gonna
still
happen
really,
week.
Really small, so. Yeah, so the Aristotelian philosophy really dominated throughout the Middle Ages in Europe.
Okay.
Except for in Islamic circles, what we would consider, I guess, the Middle East and North Africa, I guess. I'm not sure exactly where.
That sounds right.
Where it goes in that particular time period, but Islamic atomism was part of the Asharite school of Islamic theology. So this is about 11th century. So their versions of atoms were that they were perpetual materials, and that all else in the world only lasts for an instant. And these the other things were considered accidental. There was like a permanent state that were atoms, and then there were other things that were accidental. I'm not sure exactly what they classified as atoms.
Yeah.
And what was classified as accidental. I couldn't really find much information on that.
Sounds like, according to their thought, I would not be considered an atom because I was an accident. So, like, so like,
but nothing accidental can cause anything except perception, as it only exists for a moment.
Okay. I can't explain that, but that kind of makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. Like, to where, like, if it's like an accidental flash of light, like, I don't know.
I think it's kind of the idea of, like, what we perceive is accidental, and that there's a solid reality underneath it.
Okay.
Maybe is kind of what I was getting. Yeah, and of course, with their religious context, there's not really natural physical causes. Everything is the direct result of God's interventions. And so without God, nothing can happen. So, which, I mean, makes sense with their theology. It's, yeah, and not necessarily incorrect, depending on what modern people's ideas of what causes all, you know, causes nature. That's really outside of the purview of sciences.
Yeah.
Is there a God or not a God? That's not, which, I mean, maybe some people would disagree with me, but it's very difficult to, at the very least, I think everyone can agree, it's very difficult to prove
the concept of
a God.
Except for the Greeks who were like, they're on that mountain. Like, you can just climb and be like, no, they weren't. Like, sorry, checked. But yeah, like, it's because...
I mean, yeah, if you said they were on that mountain over there, you could go check.
I went and but yeah, like, I don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about it, but I can't imagine a place where we ever reach the point where we can prove whether or not there is a God or not a God.
Right.
Minus, like, being, like, him, like, coming out of the sky and being like, yo, I'm God. Like,
right.
Which would be a weird move.
I mean, yeah, and I think most religions in the modern context, you're supposed to go on faith.
Uh-huh,
right,
yeah.
It's supposed to be a matter of faith. It's just outside of the purview of science, usually. Again, with Europe still going with the Aristotelian, we get medieval Buddhism. So this is 11th and 12th century. There were actually two philosophers in the 7th century that started it off, again, before their time. And they kept with the atoms to be point-sized, durationless, and made of energy. So kind of like what we were talking about before, but it was brought back again.
Yeah.
So there's been a few iterations of it in Buddhism. And so in the 11th and 12th century, there are now written texts of the Rupa Kalpa, the existence of Rupa Kalpa.
Is that the name for atom?
Yes. So the smallest unit of the physical world. And they had it as indivisible under normal circumstances. They actually believed that you could see atoms when you reached a meditative state called samadhi. So samadhi is kind of like, is the state of consciousness someone's in when they're in a deeply meditative state. And so then you can see the atoms that make up the world, essentially. Buddhists have, with the Noble Eightfold Path, the eighth element of the Eightfold Path is samadhi.
Okay.
So it's considered...
like being able to see the fibers of the universe, kind
yes.
of. Yes. Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. We're now back to Europe and the Atomic Renaissance.
Okay. Getting done with Aristotle, finally.
Yes. And the reason why Aristotle predominated so long is because the written work of the atomists did not survive for a long time. And so the only work philosophically that they had was Aristotle's rebuttals of atomism.
Okay.
So all they saw was the negative version of it, essentially, like somebody saying, you know, that
only
this is
watching
wrong.
One news channel, yeah.
Yeah. There were a few people that independently produced their own atomistic ideas, but it wasn't until the 16th century that people really brought it back for good.
Mm-hmm.
And the first Englishman to bring back the concept was a guy named Henry Percy. He was the 9th Earl of Northumberland. And he had a group of just amateur scientists who brought back atomism and a kind of new concept called corpuscularism back into the discussion. So corpuscularism is a set of theories that try to explain natural transformations. So how chemical changes happened.
Okay.
Because of the interaction of particles, them actually, again, physically running into each other is the idea of corpusculism, and that's how change is occurring, is the atoms running into each other. It's kind of not the same as atomism, because corpuscules was the smallest property, and those had properties of their own, and they could be further subdivided. So
okay.
They didn't really have atoms, but they had corpuscules, and the corpuscules were what was hitting into each other.
Okay.
little bit different, but kind of that same, on the same line, right? So some famous scientists that actually advocated for some variation of atomism, Thomas Hobbes, Galileo, and Rene Descartes.
They I knew all, two of those.
They all, which two?
Thomas Hobbes, I could not tell you who he is, but I'm like, that name sounds familiar. And then Galileo, because like, a lot of people didn't like that dude.
Yes, yeah. Mostly for his astronomy.
Yeah.
Not,
Atomism.
Not atomism. Maybe they didn't like atomism either, but he was put under house arrest for the astronomy, mm-hmm. Earth going around the sun thing. And then in the 17th century, we had Robert Boyle and Isaac Newton. They are the ones who lay the foundation for modern chemistry and physics. Robert Boyle is considered, again, the first modern chemist. He published a book called The Skeptical Chemist in 1661. And this is the first time you kind of get what we would recognize as being chemistry.
Okay.
In the modern sense. So the questions of his book were like, what are elements? And so at this point, there were kind of two thoughts on what elements were. So one is the classic four, fire, water, earth, and air. And then some alchemists had three other ones that they also threw in there, which were mercury, sulfur, and salt.
Okay. Mercury. They got mercury.
Mercury is an element, yes.
They nailed it. And mercury, salt, and what was the other one?
Sulfur, which is also an element.
So they're two for three. kind of four for three, because salt's two elements, right?
It is two elements, but it's not what we would consider an element. And also, in the modern context of salt, there are many different kinds of salts.
Okay.
And they did not differentiate between, like, a lot of the salts.
Okay.
So it's kind of like salt.
So they're two for three, though. Mercury and sulfur?
I mean, they're kind of two for seven.
Okay. Two for seven. Hey, that's not terrible. That's a good batting average, I think.
I don't think so.
Is it not? I thought, like, if you hit, like, one out of nine pitches, like, that's... I don't know.
I guess I don't know. I don't know that much about baseball.
Me neither. I've watched it twice.
We need Ryan in here, my fiancé.
He could tell us.
He could tell us. Boyle was one of the first people to reject the idea that these were the only elements. So his main argument was that gold and silver should also be elements. And he also argued that animal bodies were made up of at least five elements, which he's not wrong, but also made up a lot more than five. And his five were phlegm, oil, salts, and earth.
Phlegm is, what a disgusting element. Phlegm, oil, salt, and earth were, okay.
Yeah, and then he continues on founding more of our basic modern understandings of atoms in his second book called Origins of Form and Qualities According to Corpuscular Philosophy. So, in those two books, he kind of lays what we first recognize as chemistry.
Okay.
And so Boyle and Isaac Newton were contemporaries of each other. So Boyle was about 15 years older than Isaac Newton, but they were in the Royal Society of London for improving natural knowledge together at the same time. And Boyle kind of came first and laid this foundation, so Isaac Newton already had that understanding and so was coming from the same place. Boyle is also really famous for having gas laws, which his gas laws are also another subject for another episode, but it really started giving some of the hints as to what our modern concept of atoms are, what were his experiments with gases. And one of the things that worked to his benefit was a lot of the gas laws. It doesn't matter whether the gas is a molecule or an element, right?
Uh-huh.
So you could have helium gas or you could have CO2. And the gas law applies about the same.
Okay, I was trying to figure out the difference between a molecule and an element. A molecule is like something combined?
Yeah, so it's just more than one element combined,
okay, cool.
Chemically.
Mm-hmm. I was nodding like I knew what it was and just wanted to make sure.
But yeah, so that worked in his favor, right? He didn't necessarily need to know what the identity even of the gases were. So Newton added on to Boyle's work with atomism and gas laws by reasoning that gases were made of particles that were mutually repelling and that the compression or expansion of the gas did not affect the number of particles their nature or their size. You know, if you're compressing a gas, it's not changing what the gas is. If you're expanding the gas, it's not changing what the gas is. You're not getting more or less particles in the same space.
Okay.
And that the atoms themselves are not changing size.
Okay.
So that really helped to solidify the concepts of what particles were and the idea of particles in motion. Right. And that's very physics. Mm-hmm. He was more of a physicist, obviously. So
yeah.
He added that like idea that there was particles in motion. It might not sound groundbreaking, but that was like incredibly groundbreaking and really if it really got people to agree to that too. Really helped start it started giving everybody a mutual language to describe describe things and start talking about science and how we would recognize it today. So and so
we're at a threshold. We're passing a threshold now.
Exactly.
Into what is more like, all right, like, this is gonna... I mean, like, these people are very smart, but, like, there's been a lot of, like, I think this, I guess this, and this is... We're getting a little bit more into, like, I'm going to study this.
Right. Okay. I can take physical measurements. These physical measurements mean something.
Okay.
And, like, there's a general agreement among people of, like, this is true.
So it's no longer someone just being like, I think the Earth has round cubes or round
yeah.
cubes.
I think the Earth is made out of... cubes.
Yeah, okay.
And that air is made out of octagons. Like,
okay.
Yeah, it's really passing, like you said, passing a threshold. And so the next big breakthrough was the idea of the conservation of mass. So, like, we've had the idea of it before, but now we have proof of it, right? So this was actually done by Antoine Lavoisier. Chemists know who that is, but other people might not. Before that, people thought that mass was lost during combustion, so when you burn something.
Yeah.
And the reason they thought that things lost mass is because gases were being given off, and there was no way to trap the gases and weigh them until the invention of the vacuum pump. So believe it or not, the vacuum pump was invented in the 17th century, which I was like, wow, that's way earlier than I would think.
Yeah.
Antoine Lavoisier was the first one who trapped everything, measured it, and said no.
Like, matter can't be destroyed or
right.
created.
Exactly.
But, like, it makes so much sense to me. Like, because I remember learning that in school and being, like, 13, 14, like, not like a, like, child. And my teacher was like, fire doesn't, like, destroy matter. And I was like, bullshit, I've seen it.
Right. Because it feels like it does.
Yeah. So, like, I 100% understand people being like, no, it, like, for sure destroys stuff.
Right, like, I had a thing, and I burned it, and it left. Yeah, I mean, it definitely wasn't dumb of people to think
yeah.
that it was destroying matter before. The second law that was established that helped was the law of definite proportion, and this was by Joseph Proust in 1797. So this law states that if a compound is broken down into its constituent chemical elements, then the masses of the constituents will always have the same proportions by weight, regardless of the quantity or source of the original substance.
Can I try to explain what that means and you tell me if I understood it wrong?
Okay.
So that means if I, like, take, like, a 20-pound piece of gold...
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I cut it into, like, equal pieces, they're going to weigh the same.
Yes, but it's talking more on a chemical level.
Okay.
So, like, if you had carbon monoxide, if you had 50 grams of carbon monoxide and you cut it in half, as in you have now have carbon and you now have oxygen, the half that is carbon and the half that is oxygen will always be the same proportion.
Okay, so, okay, I think I get that.
So, and then the same thing with, like, carbon dioxide. So instead of having 1-to-1, you'd have 2-to-1.
Okay.
By mass, anyway. So again, this was groundbreaking. because there wasn't even a universally accepted definition of what a compound and an element were. Like, we still had not agreed on that. But we're like, if you do this and you break this apart, it's always going to be the same proportion. And now we're going to get into the man that every chemist listening has been waiting for me to mention. John Dalton.
Oh, my boy John. I love him. I have no idea who he is. I'm sorry, chemist. He sounds, I don't know how I feel about his name, but John Dalton. Tell me about John Dalton.
John Dalton, he was a chemist that wanted to continue off the work of Proust and his law of definite proportions. He was experimenting with what's called metal oxides. So, you know, you have iron oxide is rust, right?
Okay.
Or one version of iron oxide is rust. Basically, with his experiments, he noticed that if you changed the ratios of the elements that you were reacting, you got different products. For example, he mixed 28 parts of oxygen with 100 parts of iron, and he got a black solid. Mm. But when he reacted 42 parts oxygen to 100 parts iron, he got a red solid, and that red solid is rust.
Okay.
So if you had less oxygen per iron, you got a black solid versus a red solid. And he found he could do the same thing with tin. So he had tin, varied the amount of oxygen, he got different substances. He had nitrogen, mixed it with different proportions of oxygen, got different substances. So, and he also noticed, which was really important, that it was always a whole number ratio. The 28 to 100 versus 42 to 100. 28 to 100 is 2 to 1, essentially. And then the 42 parts is 3 to 1.
Okay.
So it's all, and it's always a whole number like that. Whether he was doing tin, nitrogen, didn't matter. It was always, you had that whole number ratio of the amount that you were reacting. Just groundbreaking in that he proposed that each chemical element is composed of atoms of a single, unique type, and though they cannot be altered or destroyed by chemical means, they can be combined to form more complex structures.
And is that a chemical bond?
Yes. So okay. They would be chemically bonding.
Okay.
Yes.
And that's like H2O, like...
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That is the first time we got what we would modernly call a definition of a compound. Like, that is basically the same idea of what we would call a compound today. You have elements that combine to make compounds.
And they're, like, they're always the same amount. Like, that's why, like, me mixing, like, lemonade and water is not a new element. Like,
right. Not a new compound.
Not,
right.
Not a new compound.
It's a mixture.
Yeah, it's just a mixture because I can put 3/4 lemonade, I can put... Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, like, that's the same reason why if you... Like, certain things will combine in certain ratios. So if you have carbon monoxide... You have one carbon, one oxygen, always.
Okay.
And it's always carbon monoxide. You have one carbon, two oxygens, always carbon dioxide. Always the same.
I can't wait for your chemistry friends to hear this and be like, did she put a 7-year-old on this car? The lemonade and the... So he's the
professors
dude.
Like... will judge you very heavily.
So this guy, what's his name? John Dalton?
Mm-hmm.
John Dalton's like, is he like the dude? Like he is like the Michael Jordan of... Of atoms?
I guess.
He's like top five.
I would
sure.
say that he would be considered like the inventor of basketball.
Okay. I don't know who that is, but right. Okay. So like he's like, really this is the first like, all right, like this is real stuff now. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Some of the biggest flaw in Dalton's theory was that he mistakenly believed that there was always going to be a one-to-one combination between any two atoms. It just led to some errors. So he believed that water had to be HO, one hydrogen, one oxygen.
Okay.
But it's H2O, right? There's two hydrogens to one oxygen. I mean, this was partially due to his limitations in instruments, right? Like he mm-hmm. didn't, this is the 18th century now, I think. So scale, everything was still very basic.
Yeah.
Based on that, he estimated the weight of oxygen to be 5.5 times the weight of hydrogen. So, and then later he was, with some better data, he was like, okay, it's 7 times heavier than hydrogen. He was still wrong.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, he wasn't super far off, considering especially that he believed that it was one hydrogen, one oxygen.
Yeah.
And so then we get our man Avogadro. A lot of people call him Avocado. The undergrads love calling him Avocado. And this was in 1811. He had now the work of Dalton and Boyle. Avogadro expanded on the gas laws of Boyle and proposed that equal volumes of any two gases at the same temperature and pressure contain an equal number of molecules. So in other words, the masses of the gas particles does not affect the volume that it occupies. So whether you have a heavy gas or a light gas, it's still occupying the same amount of space. And so using this, he was able to show that 2 liters of hydrogen reacted with 1 liter of oxygen to produce 2 liters of water vapor at the same temperature and pressure. So what this means is that oxygen had to be diatomic, meaning that you had 2 oxygen atoms bonded, and that 2 atoms of oxygen had to separate in order to form 2 water molecules, right?
Okay.
Because you had 1 liter of oxygen forming 2 liters of water.
Yeah, okay.
So this way, he was able to get the accurate mass of oxygen relative to hydrogen, get a reasonably accurate masses for a lot of gases, and even determine if a lot of them were diatomic, which was pretty great.
So, like, this is, like, us stepping away from, like, it's not one-to-one, doesn't have to be one-to-one, mm-hmm. like, some things can be.
And so this is where we're starting to get at least the gaseous elements, what their masses are.
Okay.
And determining that these are elements, and they are different from each other, because, like, especially with gas, it's all colorless, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like iron where you get different colors or different, you know, things. Like,
yeah.
There are a few gases that are colored, but, you know, hydrogen, helium, oxygen, nitrogen, it's all colorless.
Yeah.
So being able to tell the masses apart is huge, because then it's different. You know it's different. So now we're getting into subatomic particles.
Okay, so this is Ant-Man stuff.
I guess.
Have you not seen Ant-Man?
I have.
It's very scientific.
I feel like he goes smaller than subatomic particles.
Oh, I thought that's what it was called, the subatomic. I don't know. I'll figure it out, though.
Because at one point he shrinks so small, he goes even smaller than subatomic particles.
Okay,
he gets lost and stuff.
Yeah, in the quantum realm, okay.
Quantum realm, yeah. I feel like that wasn't...
Are you telling me the superhero movie is not 100%? Scientifically accurate?
I mean, it's definitely not 100% accurate. We can't shrink a man to the size of an atom or anything.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, so until 1897, most scientists at that time would agree that atoms were the smallest unit of matter. There was nothing smaller.
So up until like 1897, what I walked in and said was true.
Yes.
Yes. I was only 133 years behind. All right.
Then we get a guy named J.J. Thomson. So Thomson was working with what's called a Crookes tube, which is a glass tube, and it contained electrodes. And then you put a voltage across it, and you saw like a green beam inside the tube. And so what Thomson discovered is that beam, if you took a magnet or an electric field, you could like change the direction of the beam in the tube. They knew that you could change it with a magnet, but the electrical field was the thing that was new. What he concluded was that the particles being emitted were not light, but were small, negatively charged particles. So it was a particle being emitted, not a light wave.
Okay.
Right? Because light was considered a wave entirely. Uh-huh. We didn't have the particle wave theory.
Yeah.
That comes later. And so he was like, this is definitely a particle, and it's negatively charged. The electron. And he was able to measure the mass to charge ratio, which he discovered was 1800 times smaller than hydrogen.
The electron is.
Yes. So the electron is 1800 times smaller than hydrogen. Or that was his measurement.
Than the hydrogen atom?
Mm-hmm.
How close was he? You said that was his measurement. I hope he nailed it. I don't understand how anyone gets this. Like, so he was just like staring at a laser and like it moved and he was like, oh man, electrons.
I mean, it's not a laser because it's not light.
It's particles. Yes. Okay.
Stared at what could be considered a lightning bolt.
Okay.
And moved it and was like, particles.
This is so interesting that, like, I don't understand scientists at all. I'm glad y'all exist, but, like, to me, I'm just like that. I'd be like, someone messed up. I don't know. I'm not that curious. We don't have to find out how close he was.
Okay.
I just wanted my boy JJ to be like, nailed it first try.
Yeah, I did not write that down on exactly what the difference is. But yeah, so that was groundbreaking in that he can now say definitively that atoms were not the smallest unit of matter. But he said that electrons were, that everything... But at this point, we know that atoms altogether are neutrally charged.
So if there's electrons, if there's negative charge, there has to be positive charge.
Right, to differentiate it. And so Thomson explained his theory using one of his favorite desserts, plum pudding. And so we have the plum pudding model of the atom, where the electrons were embedded into a positively charged matrix, like raisins in a plum pudding.
So, like, he didn't think there were protons yet.
Right, there was no concept
he
of a proton.
He thought there was, like, a positively charged blob, and then just, like, little negative charge raisins thrown on top of it.
Inside it.
Inside of it, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, because at this point, they thought of atoms as spheres. Perfect mm-hmm. spheres. And so, basically, the entire sphere was positively charged with negatively charged little spheres inside of it.
Okay. He was wrong.
I mean, he was right about the electron. He was wrong about the structure
but,
of
no,
the atom.
But, no, I've seen a picture of an atom, and it's got the little rings around it, like Saturn.
That's also wrong.
Really? That was, like, I have to change my number now. Like, it's five. I'm a five now. Because that was, like, the one thing, if you're like, what does an atom look like? I'd be like, rings.
So we'll get to that.
Okay.
You're not, you're, at that point, I believe you're, like, 50 years behind.
Okay.
Yeah. So we have discovered electrons. We think it's plum pudding mm-hmm. is the atom. That's not right. But the person that disproved Thomson's plum pudding was actually his own student, Ernst Rutherford. This was in 1909. For some other context, radium was being was isolated by the Curies, Marie and Pierre Curie, in 1898. So we kind of know what radiation and radioactivity are. It's like the beginning stages of that. And so Rutherford, along with Hans Geiger counter,
okay,
and Ernst Marsden, they wanted to study the mass of alpha particles. So alpha particles are the form of radiation that radium emits. You know, we discovered radium. We know it produces alpha particles. And so what alpha particles are in helium nuclei, so just the nucleus of a helium with no electrons.
Okay.
And those are ejected from radium atoms, right out of the nucleus. They didn't know that at the time, but that's what they
yeah.
are now.
Okay.
So they were just trying to measure the mass of this alpha particle. They knew it was being something was being emitted, so they just wanted to know what the mass of it was. And so what happened was he kept getting different measurements because the alpha particles would be scattered by the air. And so with Thomson's model, the heavy alpha particles should not be affected by air molecules in a drastic way, right? If you have just like this neutral negative space that you're putting alpha particles through, you know, electrons are really, really light, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and then you have the shell and everything is neutral based on that model, right? So anything passing through should not really be affected by anything because it's all neutral,
yeah.
right? But that's not what they observed. What they did was they created a series of experiments where they had gold foil that they bombarded with the alpha particles, and they put the whole thing under vacuum mm-hmm. so that there was nothing else getting in the way. And so if the Thomson model was correct, all the particles should pass straight through the gold, the metal foil and not change direction very much. They might skew a little bit, but not a
yeah.
lot. But what was observed was that most of the alpha particles passed straight through. There was no change in angle.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a few that had drastic changes in angle, greater than 90 degrees, right? Mm-hmm. So they got a detector that goes kind of like 180 around the whole thing, or probably maybe not 360, but you know, it goes around the whole thing
yeah.
to try to catch these alpha particles. So they were coming out back behind, instead of even just perpendicular, they were all the way mm-hmm. almost behind it, deflected. What had to be concluded was that there was a bulk of positive charge in the middle, and it could not be evenly distributed, but it was highly concentrated in one area called the nucleus.
Okay.
So he discovered the nucleus, and that's how we get the idea that there's a nucleus and then a lot of empty space.
Yeah.
So the alpha particles that didn't get moved at all were going through the empty space where the electrons are, and the ones that were getting deflected at high angles were hitting that nucleus and bouncing off.
Okay. And so we have not found protons yet, but he's like, the pudding thing is dumb. He didn't say dumb. He was.
I'm sure he didn't say dumb. That was like his professor.
Mentor, yeah. Okay.
His mentor, yeah. They were friends. They were buddies. He was wrong. He was like, you're wrong, though.
Yeah. You got to do it as a scientist.
Yeah. There's a lot of scientists out there who, like, they kind of discovered something great, and then their student was like, you're still wrong, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's still groundbreaking, but they get more detail. Mm-hmm. Like, within a few years, too. It's like 4 or 5 years later, and they're like, oh, you're wrong, though.
Yeah.
Especially in this, like, 1800s to 1900s period, there was a large, like, there was constantly shifts in what we understood of the universe.
Yeah. This
just
like
because
the
we had such.
Renaissance. Yeah, this is not still the Renaissance, right?
So the actual Renaissance. Well,
like the Adam Renaissance. You called something the Adam Renaissance.
So this is kind of past the Adam Renaissance. Because I would say the Adam Renaissance kind of ends with John Dalton.
Okay.
Because, like, they kind of were starting to gather data, but, like, John Dalton really solidified it.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So, like, we're kind of out of that revival era, I guess you would say. It's more established now. Because, like, when the animists were reviving, it was. You're going counterculture. But then it comes to a point where everyone agrees again.
Okay.
And it's no longer.
Counterculture.
No longer counterculture, yeah. In 1913, there were two major revolutions in atomic theory. The first discovery was isotopes by Frederick Soddy, and confirmed later that year by J.J. Thompson. And again, at the study, the discovery of isotopes are kind of its own whole story. We realized that there were too many elements for so many spots, right? Because you had some things that were radioactive that had the same mass as something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so at first they were like, oh, they're two different things, but then they realized that they were the same thing. Whole other story.
Okay.
The other discovery was quantum theory. So this is the theory of Max Planck and Albert Einstein. So this is the idea where light can only be absorbed or emitted in certain discrete amounts or quanta. So with this and Rutherford's nuclear model of the atom, Niels Bohr was the one who kind of puts it all together and adds electrons and orbits. So what you were saying with a nucleus with those spherical orbits around the sides, you know, you have your nucleus is like the sun and the electrons are the planets.
Okay.
So that's that idea. And this was all explained using Newtonian physics. Newtonian physics, which Newtonian physics explained the orbits of the planets really, really well. It does not explain the behavior of electrons in an atom very well at all. Basically, with Bohr's model, the electrons could not draw any closer to the nucleus, because what the issue was that, like, the sun isn't positively charged, right? The planets aren't negatively charged.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to model that with Newtonian physics, with it being a positive and negative charge, they would draw closer into each other and eventually combine. But that's not what happens in an atom, so, like, it just doesn't explain it well.
Mm-hmm.
But with Bohr's model, the electrons could not draw any closer to the nucleus because they were in those fixed energy levels.
Mm-hmm.
So without light absorbing or emitting, they were stuck in an energy level. And so when electrons did change energy levels, you got light either absorbing or emitting from the atom itself.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so we can actually observe that.
I feel way out of my depth at this point. We are past what I was certain an atom was. So the rest of this is just open sea for me.
Open sea?
Open sea. Just I'm lost. I'll go where the waves take me.
Yeah, this was really revolutionary, but again, it didn't fully explain the observations. Because we had increasingly better and better technology. So we were taking all these measurements and we're like, this just doesn't match. Because we could read the energy being emitted from atoms, right? Like these light waves that were being put off, we could measure them. We could see them. And this model could only really explain the one for hydrogen.
Yeah.
And not very well. Like it does, but it doesn't, you know? And anything more complicated than that, it did not really account for everything. In 1924, Louis de Broglie revolutionized the atomic model again by proposing that all moving particles exhibit some degree of wave-like behavior. I believe at this point we have the idea that light is both a wave and a particle.
Uh-huh.
But what de Broglie did was say that all particles are kind of waves.
Mm-hmm.
And the faster they're moving, the more like a wave they are. And the more mass they have, the less like a wave they are.
Okay.
So electrons don't have a lot of mass, and they're moving really fast. So they're also kind of more like a wave.
Yeah.
And so that can really make it where we can describe the properties of those electrons better when they're waves instead of particles.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're both, but you can kind of describe them better as waves. And so then you get Schrodinger, his cat, and equation, which explain our more modern understanding of electrons and their properties. So in his model, it's a mathematical model, electrons are treated as point charges, so they don't have any dimension to them. They're not 3D. Technically, they'd be considered 1D. And their location and motion are described in terms of a probability, so like statistics.
Okay.
It changes Bohr's model completely. So Bohr's model had those perfectly circular orbits, you're describing it like a solar system. This time you still have the nucleus, you still have that central thing, and the orbits now have a variety of shapes. They're not like orbiting in that shape, it's just a probability of where you're likely to find the electron.
Yeah, okay.
The shapes are now, you have some that are spheres, mm-hmm. You also have dumbbells and toruses. If you talk to a physical chemist, they'll say orbits are really not real.
Yeah.
They're not real either, but it's just a probability of describing where the electrons kind of are.
Okay, I think I get that.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, but this is not how they travel, but like...
Like they're not traveling in a specific path, right? They're like here, and then they're like over here, and they're just kind of like moving.
It's kind of like, I could probably find Corey at a bar, but like we don't know for sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're like, on Thursday night, I know that you're probably either going to be at Bar PM or traveling that direction.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
It's not guaranteed, but like that, okay. I think I get it. Ish.
But yeah, that's kind of where we're at today. A lot of physical chemists, computational chemists, they're all basing all their work in some way off of that Schrodinger equation.
Okay.
And that understanding of atomic theory.
What does his cat have to do with anything?
So his cat is a way that people have described Schrodinger's equation. So like, I don't really get how it, I really never understood it in terms of atomic theory, but what they say is if Schrodinger had a cat and you put it in a box,
uh-huh.
And you close that box, and in that box there's also like a poison that has a 50% chance of killing the cat.
Yeah, I mean, I know, because it's like, if you don't open the box, the cat is both alive and dead.
Right, because you have not observed it.
This is where, like, it's like, I'm too dumb for this. Like, I don't... Not too dumb. I don't have enough interest in this to, like, really... Because I'm like, no, it's not alive and dead. It's one of the two. I just don't know.
Yeah, and honestly, Schrodinger's equation is just so hard to wrap your brain around.
Yeah.
I would say there are few people in this world that really get it.
Yeah.
You know,
It's like, Schrodinger, you...
Probably me.
By the end of this episode, I'm going to throw my name in the hat.
I mean, we're just about at the end. Okay,
end of next episode.
Yeah, these folks are working with this equation all the time. And so, and the issue too is like, it's, you're doing differential calculus. And so, it's just really hard to solve. There are supercomputers dedicated to solving these equations. And we have... really only fully solved the Schrodinger equation for hydrogen and cationic dihydrogen. So there's two nuclei, but still only one electron.
Okay, because that's, the more electrons, the more complicated.
Exactly.
I'm guessing. Okay.
Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff that we do calculate, like if you see calculations about atoms and things and molecules in different systems, they make assumptions.
Yeah.
They're not calculating based strictly off Schrodinger equation, like not purely. Like,
yeah.
There are assumptions made to make the calculations easier.
Okay.
Because it's just incredibly hard to solve the equation.
Okay.
But that is where we're currently sitting with atomic theory.
Okay, that was pretty close. I was like one step away.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like when you're like 50 years, I was like, man, like atoms don't exist. Like this is gonna be the end of this.
Yeah, and I mean, like you're not. We still teach the Bohr model. Like, when we teach undergrads, we do still teach the Bohr model.
Okay.
You just also get the Schrodinger model.
Okay.
I guess you'd call it the Schrodinger model. I don't know if they call it the Schrodinger model, but, like, that the probability shapes of the orbitals, like, we still teach that.
And I guess the Schrodinger model is hard to draw.
Yeah.
It's just, like, a line with a bunch of question marks. Like, maybe. Who knows?
Well, so there are shapes that you can mathematically derive of where the probability of the electrons are. And they're called orbitals because of the Bohr model, right? So the orbit, because they were saying that it was an orbit, right? But, like, this isn't an orbit, but we still call them orbitals.
Okay.
Because, but they're not, again, they're not traveling in the path that is the shape. people describe it as an electron cloud, right? You have like
Okay, I've heard the electron cloud.
Yeah, so there's like a, just an area where the electrons are.
I feel good about it. I get it. Schrodinger, I'm there. I'm there with him. I get the equation. I'm one of the seven people.
One of the seven people.
I don't understand it at all. I'm just, I get it very conceptually.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, again, I think it's really hard to actually understand it.
Yeah.
To picture it. I mean, it's like the same idea as picturing the vastness of space. Picturing how these really tiny, really fast particles exist.
Yeah.
That it's also a particle, and it's also a wave, and it's like, it's just really hard to wrap your brain around all of it.
Yeah.
And to really say you understand it. In reality, we're also probably still wrong, right? Like, there's still something.
That's how science works.
There's still going to be some new thing that's going to add to that. Like, I mean, obviously, like, the nucleus exists, and, like, we're pretty certain on some things. Like, it's not that we're completely wrong, but there's always going to be more information coming out.
Yeah. But the nucleus does exist.
Yes.
Electrons exist.
Yes.
And they move.
And that we that I'm sure of. I'm sure they move.
Okay. I think we're pretty close to solving it.
How's our first episode?
Is this the first one ever?
This is my first one with you. It's my second one ever.
Okay. It was a lot of fun. I'm scared. I feel like I'm going to break your chair. That's why you saw me, like, shoot up.
Yeah, I mean, they're crappy plastic chairs because the university has not found me chairs yet.
I have a lot of metal chairs. They're not still not comfortable.
I'm going to say, I don't have metals any better than plastic.
Well, like, right now,
Did you break my chair?
I don't think I broke your chair. There was, like, a moment where I was like, it's going down.
Thank you again for listening to Cowboy Chemistry, where we kind of rambled on for a second there, but I'm still learning how to be a podcast host, so we're making it work. Join us next week on Friday for a special bonus episode on how to get scientifically the perfect cup of coffee.